Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but check back next week and she'll be back with us again. Our guest today is Bill Konigsberg, author of The Bridge. Bill is the author of 5 books for young adults which have won honors, including the Stonewall Book Award, the Sid Fleischman Award for Humor, the Lambda Literary Award, and the Penn Central USA Literary Award. Bill lives with his husband, Chuck, and their 2 Labradoodles, Mabel and Buford. And you can find out more about him at BillKonigsberg.com, which is BillKonigsberg.com. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Bill.
Thank you, Monica. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about The Bridge. It's got an interesting structure.
Yeah, The Bridge is a departure from anything I've done in terms of structure. What happens here, it's the story of 2 teens, 2 17-year-olds, Aaron and Tilly, who meet on top of the George Washington Bridge. They're both there to jump, and they interrupt each other. And based on what happens, the moment that the two are staring at each other 100 feet apart, both with one leg over the railing, the world splits into 4 different realities. So the structure of the book are the 4 realities. So the first story we get, Tilly jumps and Aaron doesn't. In the second story, once the first is completely done, the second story, this time Aaron jumps and Tilly doesn't. In the third, they both jump. And in the fourth, neither jump. And so this is really, it's a story, and it's a structure that's about all of the possible options of what could happen at a moment when 2 people think there are no options available.
Now, what sparked the idea for this book?
Well, I myself have a history of severe depression and had a suicide attempt in my life when I was 27. But I think the spark was a couple years ago, I was working with young people in Arizona with an organization called Boys to Men of Phoenix. And this is for troubled youth. And at that time, there was just an absolute epidemic of suicides in Arizona. It was the numbers were devastating. And right at that time, a friend of mine's daughter committed suicide, and my neighbor's son committed suicide, and I was just inundated, and that's what made me think about it. And I realized in the past I've written books in which I've dealt with coming out and being gay. I've said a lot about that, but this is a part of my life that's just as important, and I've written nothing. So I thought, you know, it's time to do a second coming out, as it were.
Is it hard to sort of identify as a former suicide attempt? Is that something you're afraid of being judged about?
I think there. I am. I mean, I've done it now. It's all over. But can't do anything about it now.
Can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Right. But you know, I think there's an amazing, terrible taboo about mental health, and not even in our country, really, in the world. We have a lot of problems speaking about, you know, mental health issues. And so, yes, I have had a sense that the way people say, how are you, recently is a little bit different than it always has been. And there's something nice about that, but it's also a little awkward.
Yeah, because it's not really, it doesn't define you.
No. And that's one of the amazing things about this insidious disease, is that depression is a little bit inscrutable. It's absolutely a disease. It absolutely exists. It's possible while depressed to have good days, and that's really confusing for people. And I'll tell you, it's confusing for me as somebody who's suffered, that I can be in the midst of a terrible depression and be laughing. So it's been a lifetime of adjusting to it, and, you know, no, it doesn't define me, but it is something that at times has felt like a definition, for sure.
And for the characters, for Aaron and Tilly, I can tell that they feel that way too. that they that they can't, it's hard for them to see beyond their depression.
Yeah, and I think that depression becomes sometimes all-encompassing, and our brains begin to lie to us, those of us who have suffered from depression. I know that when I've been depressed, my brain tells me that it would not matter whether I was here or not, that my life is completely insignificant. And in fact, that's really the impetus behind the third part of the book, which is very different than the other parts, because neither of the main characters are there. It's really all about the huge impact on people they know and some people they don't even know, their absence.
I found that really interesting. And you're not, you don't make it, you're not blatant about it. It's a little, it's kind of subtle. It's, about, you know, someone who doesn't, has no idea that they are missing Aaron or missing Tilly because they never had the opportunity to meet them.
Right. And I think, you know, it was a little bit of a spooky section to write because it's really writing in some ways about ghosts. You know, about where they could be. And of course, they're not there. So as somebody who loves Aaron and Tilly, that was very challenging to think about all of the good things that could have happened. And of course, not everything that happens in life when we decide not to jump off a bridge is good. you know, life is challenging. But it is true that there are all, you know, we cannot enjoy, we cannot know what's coming, and we cannot be here for the amazing stuff if we're not here. So I guess that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's kind of a cool way to say it.
I felt like I might have said that backwards, but I'm going to go with it.
So was this book hard to write?
It was very hard to write. You know, I'm somebody who really is I'm a character writer, and I have always gone deep into my characters to the point that my books, people always seem to say, you know, this was a light read, and then I realized that it's not a light read at all. Like, I'm reading, not The Bridge, other books of mine, where they, you know, you're really deep into characters in a way that, you know, beach reads generally aren't. And that's my little niche, you know, character books that are fun to read. But this book made me go deeper than I had ever gone, and really deeper than sometimes was comfortable, you know, that I'd be sitting there writing and crying because I was digging into characters, and those characters are a piece of me. So I was digging into feelings that, I mean, when I was 27, I took pills not to feel those things.
Wow.
Yeah,
now,
I know.
That is heavy. When you started writing this, were you from the beginning planning to do the four different ways it could happen?
I was. The only section that was unclear to me about whether I was going to write was the third section, because I didn't really know how to do it. I had thought at one point that it would just be two obituaries, and that didn't feel like something I wanted in the book. So the third part existed and then didn't. And then towards the end, my editor had a very good idea that led me to some ideas. But yes, it was always written this way. And the only difference was that I tried to write it simultaneously so that there was chapter 1A, chapter 1B, chapter 1C, chapter 1D. Well, at least the first three. And that was extraordinarily confusing to write and would have been a mess to read. But that was how a lot of it was written.
Oh, okay. So,
that makes sense.
Wow, yeah.
So chronologically.
So in the book, it each kind of outcome is separate. So you have the situation where Tilly jumps, Aaron doesn't, and you have from beginning to end of that. And then the second is the converse, where Aaron jumps, Tilly doesn't.
Yes.
But when you were writing it, you were writing, oh, wow. You were writing where they were on the bridge and both jump and neither jumps and one jumps and the other jumps. Oh, yeah, I could see that would have been
it was confusing.
Challenging, but
what I was really trying to get at, what was interesting to me, was the butterfly effect of, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings across the ocean and, you know, something happens because of that wind, you know, across the sea. I was curious to see where the characters were, how different things were for the characters who are in each of the stories. And so that was interesting to write it that way, but as you probably can imagine, would have been absolutely impossible to read that way.
It just, yeah, it would have been very, yeah, it would have been very confusing, yeah, for sure.
Yes. Yes.
Now, both Aaron and Tilly suffer from depression, and both have kind of a complicated family situation with one really good, loving, supportive parent and one really emotionally and or physically absent parent.
Right.
Was that a deliberate decision?
You know, I think in some ways it was a decision that was born from my own experience. And the way that I created Aaron and Tilly was that as a young child, my parents divorced when I was four, and I lived with my mother on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and my father moved to the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So I had families on both sides, and so as you can imagine, it was sort of having one parent, one good parent, let's go with that, on both sides of a park. And so I don't think I thought, let's do it this way, but in some ways that's the way it worked out. So that was where the split came in my own brain.
Do you think it's, I mean, the relationship with the not good parent in both cases is definitely contributing to these teenagers' mental health issues, but you can have a child with two supportive parents still have issues?
Absolutely. I mean, depression exists as its own thing, and people from all walks of life and all sorts of backgrounds can be depressed. I just chose these two characters, I think, because they were close to me. And the way I see it, you know, and I'm not sure it comes through in the book or not, but I think that Aaron's depression is more chemical and Tilly's is more situational, in that Tilly is dealing with some trauma at the moment. She's dealing with direct trauma from her relationship with her father and some other things. And Aaron, you know, what's going on isn't terrible for Aaron right now. He's just depressed, and that's how it works sometimes. He cannot figure out why he has these what feel like outsized emotions for, you know, he's upset because somebody said he wasn't good in a play, right? Like, that's not a reason that a person jumps off a bridge, except if you are depressed and your brain isn't working quite right. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, yeah. And with Aaron, I kept wanting, you know, he has these, I don't know, delusions of grandeur.
Or these
goals to be a famous musician, and and I just feel it's like, oh, why are you doing that to yourself? Why are you putting yourself through that?
It's painful, isn't it? And
yes.
And of course, you know, I those songs that Aaron writes, he's a songwriter. Those are the songs that I wrote as a teenager. Those are actually my songs.
Oh.
So I really relate to Aaron. You know, it was fun and sort of sad to put them in the book because, look, I was not a great songwriter or singer. You know, I was a 17-year-old who did, though, share some of those feelings of just needing to be praised and loved and just feeling like that wasn't happening. So Aaron, really, I really relate to him in that way.
Well, I mean, I feel like for Aaron, even though he doesn't ever really blame his mother, I do.
Sure. I understand. Yeah, I understand. Like, she's quite a piece of work. And in an earlier draft, there was more of her. But I think, rightly so, we decided there was enough going on in this book. But yeah, I mean, she is a mother who is very absent, who is very
selfish.
I would say selfish. Yeah,
yeah.
She is, and was focused on her own needs. But I don't know. I think in some ways, I don't even know how to say it. Like, as I wrote it, I wasn't blaming the mother. I was just very aware of her shadow.
And Aaron's dad doesn't blame her either, you know?
Yeah, Aaron's dad is kind of a pretty darn good dad, I think.
Yeah, and he sure is.
He's a nice man, and he has good priorities, and he's trying, you know? And yeah, I don't think he blames her. I think that he, in a sort of spiritual way, accepts what is. And what is that she is not a positive figure in either of their lives.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Bill Konigsberg, author of The Bridge. Now, this book is written for young adults, but I think it's a good read for anybody.
Thanks. And yeah. You know, I think this is also me using the platform that I have, which is as a young adult writer, to write just a book I wanted to write. I mean, I'm really glad for whoever is getting something from this. It's very, very important for young people who are struggling to feel seen. But this is a young adult book that breaks rules. You're not really supposed to have older perspectives in young adult fiction. And I just decided, well, I'm going to do it anyway. So I think it's a book for people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of the adult perspectives, of course, one of them, we talked about Aaron's father. He has this support group, these Warrior Brothers. Is this something that you're familiar with? I kind of sort of know that these men's groups are around.
Yes. Yeah, it is actually. It's something that a few years ago I found and was useful to me for about a year. It really did help me. It's called the Mankind Project, and it's part of what I guess is called the men's movement. And the men's movement is basically about creating a healthier masculinity, a masculinity that is more balanced, that allows men to feel things that are more than just anger. You know, I think there's a lot of good. In some ways, I outgrew that movement, I think, but I found it very useful. And I hope that, in fact, some other men find that, because I can see, I mean, you can see these are men supporting each other emotionally is not something we get a lot of in this world.
That's true. And I've, you know, sort of seen from the sidelines some men's groups that I felt were not very productive. There was one that went through my town a while back. Well, this is probably 20 years ago, but where part of the teaching was that basically women were responsible for the relationship and
oh my.
Yeah.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I think that this men's movement that I'm thinking about is like an ally of the women's movement of just, you know, of full equality and the feeling that in some ways it's a shame that we assign to one gender or another certain responsibilities and allowing the others to go scot-free, you know?
Right. And the thing is, it isn't actually to the benefit of the one who's supposedly going scot-free either.
No, I mean, it's that's what I, when I said balance,
what
I mean. It's out of balance, and both of these families are out of balance. The father, Aaron's father, is doing everything, and Aaron's mother is doing everything, and both other parents are checked out.
Yeah, or Tilly's mother is doing everything, yeah.
That's what I meant, Tilly's mother.
Yeah.
Her father is a piece of work, too.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sad. And then the fact that she is adopted and is Korean, adopted by a white American family, you don't delve into that, to that kind of cultural, dislocation a lot in the book, but it certainly does play into her situation.
Yeah, well, it's an odd time and an odd situation when we write across ethnicity. And had this book been in first person, I wouldn't have even done it. But instead, doing a close description in third person, omniscient, I felt able to make that sort of jump. But I didn't want to spend a lot of time writing things that aren't really authentic to me. So it is covered, it's in there, but it's the purpose of it, the reason that she is a person who is adopted, is because I wanted her to feel like a stranger in her own family in a way, and in a way feel not that way. So, you know, I interviewed quite a few people who were adopted to just fill in the blanks for myself about what that's like. But otherwise, I felt like a stranger in my second family, my father's side. I felt like he had another child after me, and I felt like they were this family unit, and I was this stranger who showed up every once in a while.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that. Now, the other thing that I found interesting is that for Aaron, who is gay and he's out, being gay doesn't really seem to be his...
Right.
It isn't really the issue for him.
No, you know, what I tried to do, and I suppose what I did, was rather than this being a book about a teenager who wants to kill himself because he's gay, it's a teenager who wants to kill himself and he's gay, which is different, you
yes,
know, because,
yes, yeah.
You know, everything in my life is impacted in some way by this difference in me. You know, it's not all the headline, but it's there. And so I wanted to explore that. And I'm always interested in exploring this interesting new world where, in some pockets at least, being gay is entirely okay. You know, and so his school is ready to do an assembly for him, but he doesn't need it. So
right.
it's something I make fun of, but I'm making fun of with joy. You know, I think it's lovely that schools are trying to be helpful to kids who feel, you know,
and his parents are fine with it. And
yeah,
but the problem that he had, the problem that being gay causes for Aaron is, he can't find a boyfriend.
Yeah, and that's right. He is in a situation where his sexual orientation is entirely theoretical at this point. You know, he knows who he is, but he hasn't ever had a boyfriend. And I can say that from being a gay teen, that was one of the, there were many bigger bummers when back in the 1980s when that was my situation. But
yeah.
One of them that definitely was true is it's impossible to find a boyfriend. There just weren't as many people out there who were available.
And of course, it doesn't help to realize that a lot of straight guys can't find a girlfriend, or straight girls can't find a boyfriend either. You don't really think about that.
No, everything is that's right. Everything is so immediate as a teenager, and that's kind of why I've always written about teenagers. I love that passion of just, you know, everything feels so important in the moment,
which is great, or in this case, really not. I mean,
it's not great. It's painful. I mean, you know, when we feel that we're the only person in the world struggling with what we do, what we're struggling with, I think it's very isolating. And one of the messages I hope, but one of the messages I intended to put into this book is that we're not alone. You know, that there are other people who are struggling as well, and that. It really, in part four, when Aaron and Tilly find each other, they find somebody who they didn't know existed, who can completely relate to the other's problems. I mean, they might not have the same problems, but they can surely relate to them.
And you do actually deal with the situation where being gay is not okay to everyone, and where it's a struggle to come out. A little more indirectly in the book, but it's actually, You know, how did you come up with the idea of Tilly? I don't think we're giving away too much to say that Tilly gets ghosted by her first boyfriend, and she's, you know, really, really upset about it, and then that leads to some other things that are even more upsetting. And the reason is, you know, the boyfriend has a reason that has nothing to do with Tilly. Was that something that just came to you as you were writing, or did you know going into it that that would be the case?
It came to me while I was writing. I knew that there was a reason. I think I had written the sentence something like, sometimes ghosting isn't ghosting, and it's from the point of view of the boy, Amir. And I didn't know what it meant. I just know that he had something going on, and then it dawned on me. And a lot of my writing goes that way. I mean, for me, you know, they talk about the difference between a plotter and a pantser, mm-hmm. somebody who, you know, plots or writes by the seat of their pants. I'm more of a pantser. You know, I had to outline this book because, oh my gosh, it would have been impossible to write without it, but I'm really interested in the surprises I find along the way. I think that that's often the most interesting stuff.
I think there are a lot of writers that are in that camp, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I like to read. I mean, I can't ever tell what's going on for a writer, but sometimes things feel surprising in a book. And I'd wonder, I'd be interested to ask some writers about that.
I do, and I do.
I guess that's your job.
And a lot of them do. Yeah, they do get surprised by it. And that's why I ask, you know, was that, you know, how did that happen? So let me remind our listeners that our guest today is Bill Konigsberg, author of The Bridge. And Bill, why don't you read from the opening of The Bridge for us?
I'd love to. Let me read the opening section. This is the part that sets up the four different realities. So it is April 17th, 3:54 p.m. Can't I have this one moment to myself, please? This thought sears in Aaron Boroff's mind as the sobbing girl passes behind him. She's interrupted his solitude as he stares down at the undulating Hudson River from the south side of the George Washington Bridge. He senses her presence as strongly as he feels the concrete walkway shaking frantically below him. He glances right and watches her walk toward New Jersey, head down. Then she stops maybe 100 feet from him, approaches the ledge, and stands there, looking down at the empty space below her, just as he'd been doing. He turns and glares at her. It's hard to see details from this distance. She's short, with long jet black hair. Devastated, definitely. Same reason for being here? Probably. He wonders, which one of us is worse off? His gut twists. Her, of course. I'm such an effing coward to even be thinking of ending my life. People will forget about me because thinking about me is too embarrassing. I'm a failure in every way, and I probably won't even manage to kill myself right. At the same time, he can't imagine withstanding this hole in his chest even a moment longer. Too much. It's like when he was 8 and he wanted his mommy, only to remember she wasn't living with him anymore. Thinking this makes him sob audibly, and even though the vehicles and the wind and the buckling bridge are louder and more chaotic than anything he's ever blared on his headphones, the girl turns her head toward the sound, toward Aaron. It's too far for eye contact, really. What they share is the basic idea of eye contact, and Aaron feels it for both of them. Awkwardness. Why couldn't she have walked just a little further? This is Tilly Stanley's time. And here is this interruption, this lost waif of a boy, his hair blowing in the hectic wild wind. Tall, narrow, leaning in on himself like a branch about to snap. And she thinks, does this boy have to be here? And then she thinks, you know what? F him. I'm so tired of letting other people dictate my life. She looks away and grasps the nearly petrified metal railing with her hand and lifts her leg onto the other side so that she's straddling it. If he even tries to walk in her direction, she'll let go and end it. That's how serious she is. Her throat bone dry, her chest empty, her head spinning wild. Then the boy straddles the railing too, and Tilly is like, oh, come on. Suddenly they're facing each other like they're playing a deadly game of dare. Aaron wants to scream at her, leave me alone. This moment is mine. This is all I have left. Tilly's brain is mottled with warring thoughts she can't quite decipher. She only knows they're getting in her way. Be a big girl, she berates herself. Pick up your damn thick leg and walk far enough away so that he can't see you anymore. But she's stuck there. She is too far gone, much too far gone to imagine suffering even one more minute of this life. No, oblivion is the only answer. Whatever comes after, nothing or a lot of something unknown, cannot be worse than this. It's time to stop, to end. They remain that way for a few seconds, then a few seconds more. Eye contact without being able to see each other's eyes. And then at 3:57, and that's the beginning of the introduction to the bridge.
Wow. And, you know, you want to, and if you want to know what happens next, four different things happen next.
Right. Right. Depends on which of the stories. And of course, we start with the one where Tilly jumps.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill, when did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I knew sometime in high school. I was not a great high school student. I didn't really care about a lot of the things that I was being taught. And I took a creative writing class, and I absolutely loved that. And at the same time, I was searching through New York City. It's a different time, of course, for stories about people who were like me, gay people. And so I found a bookstore that had those stories called the Oscar Wilde Bookshop. And they were thrilling to me. It felt like for the first time in my life, I was being seen for who I was. And I think those two things together made me feel like I want to write stories like this.
And your first book was published in 2013. Was that and that was called Openly Straight.
There's one before that.
Ah, okay.
It's okay. In 2008, my first book was called Out of the Pocket. It was not a big seller. It won the Lambda Literary Award, and it was just a coming out story with a sports background. And I was a sports writer, so that's where that comes from. I'm a very diverse person.
Yeah, yeah, I'll say. So, yeah. So that was in 2008. And how old were you then? Or you don't have to tell me if you don't want to.
Oh, it's fine. I was 37, and I had written that book starting when I was about 32, 33. So it was a very different thing to write about a 17-year-old as a 32-year-old than it is today as a 50-year-old.
Yep. Ah, yeah. So, so, well, I'm older, so anyway. Was that the first book that you wrote or just the first that you published?
In my early 20s, at college and right after, I wrote a really terrible book called Native New Yorker. It was bad to the point that a friend of mine wanted to read it and kept bothering me. And after he read it, he gave it back to me. He just handed it back to me.
Oh, I think with no comment.
No comment. Just here you go. And I think, you know, I think, and I don't want to generalize for everybody, but I certainly had in me a whiny, woe is me book that needed to be written. I'm just not sure it needed to be read.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So, of the six books now that you've published, counting The Bridge, is there one that is like the most autobiographical for you?
They all have pieces of my autobiography, and they all have metaphorically a lot to do with my life, but none of them are really autobiographical. I think I have a tendency to transcribe my own experience into a fictional world. There is one that I'm writing right now that feels a little bit autobiographical, but I'm still changing things, because it's just, I really find fiction to be the most interesting. I mean, fiction is ordered, you know, life itself is chaos.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. So so nothing, none stand out. The Bridge has a little autobiographic material in there, but not enough to really call it that.
Right. Is there a character that you identify with the most?
I think Aaron, especially because he wrote my childhood songs.
Well, true, true. Which,
yeah, so.
I gotta say, they weren't that bad.
Oh, no, I mean, they weren't. They were
no.
Teenage, you know,
no.
They're teenage songs.
I mean, there's a lot of songs, lyrics that are cliche,
right.
And, you know, just
right.
Not
right.
Great.
And you know, it's just that at 17, those were the lyrics that meant the most to me. And if I look at them at 50, I think, oh, they're sweet, but I don't think they necessarily touch the, you know, what was really going on at that time. Yeah, I don't know. I hate to be critiquing my 17.
Okay, so I remember being like 16, 17 years old, and we all, this was back before computers and anything like that. So it was a thing to have these poetry books that were loose leaf, and then they're in these binders that have those little metal clips in them and stuff. And you would write down sayings or copy song lyrics or write your own things in there, and you'd maybe do little drawings in them. And we all had these, you know. And I'm not sure. I guess now people make TikToks instead, but kids,
right.
Which is a lot, you know, that you can make money at. But anyway, if we could. So I remember having found mine like years later, probably, trying to think, probably about 20 years later, having found this notebook and looking through it, and I'm reading it, and I come to this one poem, and I'm like, this is really good. And it didn't have a name on it. And I said, and I don't remember writing this, but it is really good. Yeah.
That's lovely.
But guess what?
Yeah.
Then I started, I was one of the first people to have computers. So I had a computer at this point, and I went on the internet, or somehow I found out that it was actually a Jim Croce lyric.
Oh, I see. I understand. Right. Right. Because it all is jumbled together.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Is this a poem or a lyric?
Yeah. Yes. And usually I would have written who it was by if it was by somebody else, you know, and I, for some reason, didn't do that on this one. So I was mentally taking credit for a Jim Croce lyric, which obviously, as he was one of the great lyricists of all time. So, yeah.
Yes, indeed. That's funny.
Yeah. So, so you were, was sports writing what you did first? Was that like your first career?
It was. I was a sports writer from 1994 until I went to grad school in 2002. And then even after, I went back to the Associated Press and was a sports writer and editor. After grad school for 3 years.
Now, was grad school an MFA in creative writing?
It was, yeah. And I am really glad that I did that. I learned so much, but moreover, it really gave me a chance to pursue this and to be a writer. Because everybody thinks they're a writer, right? I mean,
yeah.
Because we all have a book to write.
Right.
But I wasn't behaving like a writer, and this gave me a chance to actually write.
And where did you do the MFA?
I got my MFA at Arizona State University, which is close to where I live now. So I'm back there.
And is that, was it a resident, you know, I know that there's programs that are on campus, and then there's some that have low residency. Was this an on campus program?
This is a resident program, and it was a 3-year program rather than some of them are just 2 years.
That's a big commitment to make in the mid-career. And
it was.
And I can see why you're very glad that you did it, but what made you take that leap?
I think that I knew that I wasn't supposed to be a sports writer. Or any kind of journalist. I knew that that was the way that I made money, but really I was not fulfilled. And I thought, I'm in my early 30s. It's not going to get any easier. If I'm going to do this, I have to do it now. And I just, made the decision that that's what I was going to do, and it would cost an amount of money, and I would be paying for it for a while, but oh well.
I love the saying when people, like, as adults are thinking about going back to school or something, and they say, but, in 4 years I'll be, or like in this case, in 3 years I'll be 37. If I do this in 3 years, I'll be 37. And the answer is, yeah, and if you don't do it in 3 years, you'll be 37.
It's exactly right. We have all of these ideas as if there's something that can change that fact.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
And you're either going to do it or you're not.
And it's never too late.
No,
really.
It isn't. I mean, I thought at the time that the fact that I was going to graduate at 34 was insane, but really 34 is quite young.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is, especially from my perspective.
And mine too.
I dropped out of college to have a child when I was quite young. And I always thought I would finish, and I made a couple attempts at it. I went back at one point, and then literally the day that I went for orientation, my father died really unexpectedly. Completely unexpectedly, and he was only 49, and I had to take over his business, so I dropped out again. And then I tried I guess that was really the last. No, then I would do like night courses, evening courses and stuff after that, but I never finished. And I always thought I would finish before my kids did. I had two kids. They both, one has a bachelor's, one has a master's degree. I never got beyond the second year. However, I've had an immensely successful career in business as an entrepreneur, and this Writer's Voices is really just a sideline that I do with my mom because I wanted to have something to engage with her on a weekly basis, and she had a career in radio, and we had the opportunity to do this, and she's now 85, and we're still doing it, but the reason she's not with us today is it's a little much for her to read a book every single week, and so we kind of do, every other book she does with me, but
nice.
So,
well, yeah, I mean, going to school is not the be-all and end-all, and also, life isn't over. My aunt got her degree at 84.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I still have time.
Absolutely, there's time.
And the great thing about it is if I do it now, I don't have to think about, am I going to be able to make a living with what I'm studying? Because I've already done that.
We have so much more wisdom at this point. You can actually learn something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I wish that I had done that in college. I didn't learn very much. I was not paying close attention.
Well, part of the reason that I did drop out was my father he wasn't a real fan of going to college, even though he was an Ivy League grad himself.
Oh.
Because he thought that you should wait and figure out what you really want to do before you go to college so that you get the most out of it when you go.
Interesting.
Yeah. But it is hard, as you know, once you're out in the world making a living, you have a mortgage or whatever, to stop it all and go to college.
Yes. Well, yeah. I don't know that I would ever ask anybody or recommend to anybody to take my path. I've made so many mistakes, but at the same time, I look at where I am and I love where I am. And so somehow this very non-traditional way of doing things worked.
Well, I could say the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. It
yeah.
sounds that way.
Yeah.
Sounds that way. Yep.
So you're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Bill Konigsberg, author of The Bridge. So, Bill, when you got through your MFA and you were writing, was it hard to get published when you were first starting?
It was. This was right before getting an agent and or an editor was done by email. So this was the time still of snail mail.
And when you were only supposed to send to one person at a time and wait for them to.
Right.
Yeah.
So it took a really long time to find an agent. And then even then, my agent was only submitting to two editors at a time. I couldn't tell you why. Maybe that was how things were done back then. But it took years, really, to get set up. So if I finished the book in 2004, I think I got my contract in 2006.
And you were continuing to write during that time?
Yes, I was writing not anything that got published, but I had two other books that I was busy working on at the time, and they are now safely in my drawer.
So in total, you have three drawer novels.
I have three drawer novels and six published. That's exactly right. So I'm batting 67%.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's not bad at all.
Or it's a D in college. It's a D, I think.
Well, how did you determine that those books weren't the ones? Or did you try and sell them and they just didn't?
I in fact, the second one I wrote was purchased by Penguin to be the novel that was going to be after Out of the Pocket, and my editor left and orphaned the book, and the editor that I was that I wound up with didn't like it, and so Openly Straight, my second novel, was the replacement for that. And by the time I got ready to try to sell it again, it just felt a little stale. So I stand by it and say it was a pretty good novel, but I'm perfectly fine with the fact that it was just practice. And the other one was an adult novel. And I think it might be in some ways one of the maybe the best thing I've written. It's in terms of skill and in terms of prose. But I'm really glad that an agent was working with me for quite a while and he finally just decided he didn't want it. And I'm really glad in the end because it's really dark. And I'm not a dark person. I have dark parts of me, but I really like to write books that are more hopeful.
So The Bridge is, although it does have a hopeful ending, there's a lot of sadness in there. I got to admit, I cried a few times. And also, I just felt so much pain for these young people.
Yeah. I mean, it is a sad book. And I've heard people describe it as heavy. You know, it's so important to me, that part of hope. Like I hear what you're saying, but I wouldn't want that book to be out if there wasn't the fourth part of it.
Yeah. Now, social media also plays a part, and it seems like for teens now, it's really can be devastating. I mean, it seems like even if you're not depressed, and even if you're a fairly popular kid, are they really so wrapped up in how many likes they get on things and how their lives on social media?
I mean, it seems that way. You know, for all of the writing that I do, I don't have children. But I will say that I think it must be so challenging to be a teenager right now. The types of pressure that are on young people, things that I couldn't even have imagined as a teenager. And I think social media plays a big part of that.
Yeah.
You know, when your life is out on display for everyone to see, I can't imagine.
I'm just trying to figure out, like, my grandkids are getting to that age now, and the oldest just turned 11. How do you protect them from the damaging consequence or the damaging effects of the social media world.
And I think that you can't. I mean, you can. You can just deny access. But for most people who will have children who are somewhere on social media, I think the only thing that you can really do is keep the lines of communication as open as possible. You know, of course, a lot of parents want to do that and the kids cut them off. But, you know, to let kids know that they are not alone, and that anything that happens is nothing that happens is beyond what you can tell me kind of stuff. I think that's important, communication.
I know that thinking back to being a teenager that, like you said, there's so much immediacy. It seems like everything that happens is so important. And yet when you look back on it, you realize that hardly any of it really matters in the long run. Being
right.
popular or being in the certain group or being or getting this award or winning that has no effect on the rest of your life, really.
Nothing. But you can't say that to a young person.
No.
That doesn't work. I'll tell you a quick story. I went to my 25th high school reunion and had the opportunity to sit in a circle with 25 of my classmates. We just happened to sit in a room together, and we went around and talked about our lives, and everyone had a chance to share about what high school was like. And it floored me to find out that people who I thought had everything and had everything going hated high school and felt terrible. Like, we're all at the same time going through the same thing. Every single one of us is struggling in our own way. And I don't think you could tell a teenager that and have it make any difference, but that's the fact. We're all going through that junk.
Yeah. And I think when I really realized that was my youngest brother, who's like 8 years younger than I am, seemed to have it all. He was really good looking. He was really athletic. He was very musical. He was the student body president. And he stuttered.
Oh, right. Right. And
yeah.
So that became the thing. That was the thing.
Yeah, sure. It was like I think anxiety related. So even though he would look like he was the king of the world, he had the same, same insecurities, put it that way, as any of the rest of us. And probably people looking at me thought the same thing, you know, that I had everything. And yet I felt very insecure.
Yep. I think that's the high school and teenage experience in a nutshell. And it's without a cure.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah. Bill, tell us what you're working on now.
I'm working right now on three projects at once, so I'll focus on the one that's young adults. My next book is called Destination Unknown, and it takes place in the 1980s in New York City. And it's a love story, I suppose, a love story and a friendship story. I can't decide if it's a love story, but it's two kids who become very important to each other. Dealing with New York City in the 1980s with the AIDS epidemic as the backdrop.
Oh, wow.
They're two gay boys. And really, when I said earlier that I'm writing something that's autobiographical in some ways, that is as close as I can get. That was the greatest trauma of my life, was coming of age while a whole world was dying around me. That was very tough.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And are the other projects books, or are they something else?
They are books. I'm working on a middle grade novel writing with a friend of mine. She and I are writing sort of back and forth. It's a book by email. It's all emails.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's sort of fun. And I'm also working on an adult novel that is about kind of coming of age at 50. It's like it's still a coming of age story, but it's about what does it mean to be an adult and a mature adult?
So. You know what? It does seem like 50 is about the age that starts to happen these days.
I just turned 52 weeks ago. And yes, I will say so.
Yeah. One of the disadvantages of doing things, or maybe advantages, I don't know, of doing things the way I did, which was having children really young, is you have to grow up really
right.
young. So I've been an adult for way too long.
I so understand what you're saying, and that's the big difference. My friends who are adults all had kids.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Right. The rest of us are all a mess.
Well, fortunately, if you have kids, I mean, there are a lot of people who have kids and don't become adults, and Aaron and Tilly in The Bridge had parents like that. So
yes.
it's not a slam dunk.
That's correct. That's true. It's too easy to say that, but certainly there is pressure to grow up fast
right.
to have children.
Right. Yeah. Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We're just about out of time. Do you have any final words of advice for a would-be writer?
Oh, final words of advice. I think just put your butt in the chair and keep going. You can't become a writer if you're not writing.
Exactly. And usually my mom has a quote at the end, and so I looked up one for us today that I thought fit with this book. And it is, "Let your hopes, not your hurts, shape your future," by Robert Schuller.
That's amen.
Amen. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Bill.
Thank you so much. Really, really nice to speak with you.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.